anything that has come up for anybody overnight before I sort of launch into the next part we're going to look at today? From yesterday, you left away where you've been sitting away. Are there any kind of wonderings or clarifications, please? Any questions? Let's do that for a few minutes to begin with.
Hi, I'm Caroline. How do you advise us in when we notice that we're not on our primary object, and then we come back to the primary object? Would you go through that process? Because sometimes I just flip into it, and it's like it goes back and forth so fast that.
Thanks, Caroline. One thing to say is that we didn't realize we weren't on it. And so we were, that's why we use the word lost, and we didn't even know we were lost. Until we are no longer lost. And so in a moment we realize, we just now are here enough to realize we just weren't here. But we didn't do either of those things. We didn't get lost. We didn't choose to get lost. It wasn't a thing that we actually engaged our intention into doing, and we didn't even come back to intentionally, because we weren't there to come back. Suddenly we find ourselves present again. And that's pretty remarkable, I think, because it's like, how did that happen? Who's in charge anyway? And so it's like, okay, so my mind gets confused and then it releases itself somehow. And so the sense of me is more just watching that process. So to be able to realize that the mind goes away and then the mind shows up again, like present awareness is lost and then it reappears magically, to the part that's recognizing that isn't any of that, it's behind that. And so this behind awareness capacity, Saito Watejaniya says it's like we have two minds. We have that mind that thinks things and gets involved, and then we have this one behind it that can see it all. Well, what we're doing here, we're very lost and involved, and that's, we're brilliant at that. We're way too good at that. That's the executive assistant totally overrunning the whole show. But what we haven't developed is the one that's behind that, that's always there. And so we lose that one and get into the little one, and then we find that one again. So what we're doing in practicing is developing that, the constancy of that overview kind of aspect of the mind. So we sort of switch allegiance. Okay, so get back to your question. So when we are suddenly aware again in our big mind, as it were, in our behind mind or overview, whatever you want to call it, wise perspective, seeing that, first acknowledge that that has happened and that there's a difference between being, having lost that overview awareness and now having, being back there again, and feel the difference. That's the most important thing, because when we are able to be conscious and experience confusion and freedom from confusion over and over and over, there's actually a qualitative difference in the feeling of it. When we're present again, there's a whole lot of things going on that aren't there when we're not. It feels bigger because all of our faculties are now available to us. When we're present, we can hear things, smell things, there's the body, there's the energy in the room, there's all, everything that's really happening is now something I'm available to it. We're connected again. It's brighter, it's richer, it's clearer. It's often less juicy, which is why we got all sucked into the other anyway. But the thing about the juicy is it's sticky, and it's oppressive, and it's intense. And we're buying into it, and believing in it, and caught in it, we're entangled. But it's pressure and sticky, and it's not very bright or clear or light or spacious or friendly or anything. It's magic. It's intense. It's like we're in the TV instead of sitting on the couch, a comfortable place at home, sipping our nightcap and watching something. We're like in it, gripped by it. So we can feel the qualitative difference in those moments, briefly, the present moment and then the lost moment. And then the system gets to prefer the present moment, just because it's actually all those other things which are what we prefer, what feel more wholesome, free. Then, and this is all very rapid, but nevertheless, over and over, as you were asking, then when we're like, oh yeah, here I am, suddenly I've been spat out by that, whatever that drama was. I have this image which I've described as like, you know, so there's an old-fashioned washing machine, which is one of those like ones. You're on the edge, and then you're in it, and then you're on the edge, and then you're in it, and then you're on the edge. It's like, oh, thank God I'm on the edge. It's kind of like, okay, right, now I realize what's happening. Let that be the primary understanding that comes from that process. And so now you're present again. In time, as meditators, as we develop that present awareness, that's all we're needing to do. And so that present awareness can include a mood here, and an itch here, and a sound here, and whatever it may be, an idea coming through here, but we don't lose that stable back big mind. But when it's not yet accessible or stable, or we're in a particularly vulnerable time or tired time, or the life is a bit intense and we can't access it so readily, then we anchor ourselves to the present with something which is here, which helps us stay here, like breathing, like the hands, like, you know, I'm going to zero in on the faculty of hearing sounds, because they are functioning in the moment. So if we hang on to them or use them, they'll help us stay in present awareness. But it's not about the anchor. You can choose whichever one you like, and you can shift those around, and it could be loving kindness phrases, they could be breathing, they could, whatever. It's not about them. They're just aids to be present. And so don't rush to that anchor. It's not about the anchor. It's being present, and enjoy being present and what that feels like. And then time goes by, and you're sitting in meditation, and it's quiet, and now what you're going to do, you can relax your awareness and let it know that you're aware. You can even start investigating awareness itself. Now, this isn't going to be for everybody, and for new people, that just sounded like gobbledygook, so don't worry about it. But it's like the quality of your awareness is what frees us. If our awareness is really, really clear, there's no hooks, there's no getting caught, there's no adding stories and adding anything, opinions. It's just, this is what's happening, this is what's happening, this is sort of open, clear, seeing the flow of life unfold. There's no hooking, no challenge, no triggering. And then we find ourselves getting a little bit involved or in hooks, so we go, okay, I'm going to hang on. It's sort of like climbing, going for a walk on slightly uneven terrain, and sometimes you have to grab on the side. You need to hold on, you know, you need, and it's really rough, you need like ropes and things when you're climbing up mountains. I've never done that, but you need ropes and the two, because walking along isn't stable enough. It's too scary. You're going to get into trouble, so you need some aids. So these various objects of connecting aids to help us stay present. So we use them in that skillful way.
Well, I am new, and this is my first retreat. And when I got home last night, I was in the washing machine, and it was on full education. What happened? You know, I was just thinking that my day yesterday was like a vacation for my brain. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I was in this washing machine.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Flashing around.
Yeah.
Well, guess what's your name?
Helene.
Helene, guess what, Helene? The thing is, somebody else was speaking to me at the end of the day yesterday, too. Thrashing around in the washing machine is quote-unquote normal. Mm-hmm. It's what we're like. We know anything else. When we learn this other view, we can actually get out and be on the edge. What a relief is that? And then we get to see, one of the main thing we get to see when we're on the edge of the washing machine is just how thrashy it is in there. And it's shocking and it's overwhelming. I think, how can I ever extract myself? It's just so intense. And how much do I do it, and how neurotic am I? Oh my God. And so it's upsetting initially. It's extraordinary to realize it. But the fact that you can realize it shows that you're not in it all the time. Because when you're in it, you don't have a clue you're in it. No one knows when they're in the midst of a rage that they're in the midst of a rage. They're completely lost in that rage. You know that. You yourself, you got totally lost in it. And so it's the beginning of coming out of it is recognizing what it is. And one of the reasons why meditation is everybody's most popular activity is because you actually have to see thrashing and experience thrashing over and over and get to understand the mechanics of it and how different things suck you in and what they do and what they make you feel like and then what they make you think. Because if you feel in a certain state like the mother, you're going to have these offspring of thoughts coming out of that, and then you're going to behave in ways and so on. And what we're doing is unpacking that whole process and recognizing how it works, and how then I work, and how then I function, and contribution to the energy of the planet actually is in any moment. And it's sobering, it's embarrassing sometimes, but it's the only way is revealing, because when we know, we can choose. When we're on the edge of the washing machine, some option to not fall in again in the next moment. We have some option, only some. Because sometimes it sort of reaches out and gets us. And we don't know how that happens or when it happens. Certain things just do that because we're constantly bombarded with stuff, and some of them have a hook. And so we're seeing this over and over and over, but the whole process over time, and it's a reprogramming, so it's a relearning new cells in the brain and pathways, and they're measuring all this now with their incredible instruments. They can see this process, that it's an ongoing developing thing. And it's kind of like you're learning a new program. You're learning a new way of perceiving everything. But you can't just switch it on, unfortunately. You have to grow it, and it takes its own time. But it gains in momentum because the effect of this new program, the spaciousness, the space enough to be able to make a choice and not be completely the victim of the water machine, is so worthwhile that it's worth keeping on doing the training. It's, you know, give you increasing enthusiasm and all those things that I was saying yesterday, that we need to get started, and then you just get more established. So it's sort of, if you could like think of meditation, it's sort of like an addiction, and you're already caught. Like, you just need one few moments of understanding the difference. There's no way to access this any other way than changing the mind. And so, you're another Buddhist who's hooked. Like it or not. Forget it. You could try and forget it, and you'll never really forget it.
My name's Kathleen. When, after the long length of time, and you've meditated, do you get finally to the state where you're more in the other brain?
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
And so that's what happens.
Oh yeah, so here's this image. So this is the uninstructed worldling is one of the things the Buddha described. There's no training, right? And so, starts up like this. And so your awareness, the untrained awareness, is like a little marble or something, a little ping pong ball, sitting on an upturned bowl, and it's very hard to stay there. Off it goes, it falls off anywhere else. As you practice meditation, this upturned bowl gets shallower. It's upturned, but it gets to be more concave, so that the ball of your attention doesn't rush off so rapidly. With more practice, it becomes more and more flat, until your awareness can be on one plate now, or over to one side, or off kind of. It's as easy to go on it or off it. With more practice, it starts to invert the other way. So it's easier to be present, but you can easily slide off and out depending if the foundation is a little tippy, out you go. And as time goes by, it gets more and more like that, so that your default setting is being present. And once in a while, a big thing happens and you fight with your sister. Well, I fight with my sister, and I'm out of there. So it's not like there is an enlightened person. There's a mind that's more and more present, more and more aware, that occasionally, in certain circumstances, loses its awareness. It gets, it's sort of a progression like that. So it's not like suddenly, finally, switch and that's it, it's all over. Until one becomes so completely free of everything that there is no returning to losing your awareness. And that's, it's just a progression.
I find early in a meditation, my thoughts, the thoughts that come up are more compelling and they're more rational, and so they're easier to get hooked into and harder to get out of. But then once I get a little bit of calm and concentration, the thoughts start getting random and silly, and they're kind of interesting from that perspective, but they're also easier to say, I don't need to pay attention to you, and just go on by.
And I wonder how much of it's that the thoughts that change, or that you are developing more of the big mind and the thoughts are kind of losing their apparent validity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because of perspective. I think that's all that changes, because I think the thoughts still are thoughts, But when we just have the thoughts and we have no overview awareness, they seem so valid. And as we become a little more zoomed out, as it were, Google Earth type, it's like they are just thoughts, actually. Mm-hmm. And so they have less power, how the process goes, exactly. Yeah. And that goes on through life, not just through a sitting, but you described it in a sitting as well. Please.
I'm Karen.
Hi, Karen.
I had never used sound as my object before, and I enjoyed trying it. I think it, I was in the present moment, but you talked about some suggestions about how to directly experience the sounds and not label them, and I couldn't do that. Like I would like taking an inventory. How many more sounds can I hear? Or, you know, but all be labeled in my head before I could sort of register them. And I guess I'm just wondering, what would it be like to directly experience things without labeling?
This is a great comment, and it's a very interesting process that you're describing. Well, first of all, there's some part of you, the big part, that knows that you were labeling, and that there's this constant commentary about this. There's a T in the States called constant.
Yeah.
Who thought that up? And so you're able to see that. Well, the part that's seeing that is the overview. So you're recognizing that that's what the mind does. It just gets involved with every little, and it does with everything. And so to be able to see that means you're already not completely in that. It isn't just train you're aware of. It's like you're here, hearing, and there's a train sound, and your mind is recognizing it. You're seeing that whole thing. And so what happens just with more and more practice is you see that they're not the same. And there are times when a sound can register, and you can choose or not whether to involve yourself with the name of it, the labeling. And it doesn't let you switch it off. You can't switch it off so much. It's that rather like Steve was just saying, instead of the name and your opinion about it and the story being predominant, you can shift your attention to the thing itself and let the mental extra, which is an extra thing that the mind's putting on top, is busily putting things on top. You don't give it so much juice, is all. You sort of withdraw your attention. You stop investing so much in the description and your opinions of things, and you just let the sound be the sound. You let the train go by without having to get on and worry about which one it is and if it's late. And so that is a process that just is part of the process. But with sound, it's relatively accessible to see how you do it. Whereas with other things, like thoughts, you get in there and you have an opinion about a thought right away, and it's hard to tease them apart. With sounds, because they're so impersonal, and they didn't come from you, and clearly you didn't do anything about making them happen, and most of them are pretty benign in their effect, unless it's a very offensive sound, or unless it's carrying a word from a person that's about you, then it's, that's hard. But when it's less personal, then you can see that process. And so it's useful, because the program is with everything, but you can recognize it and practice around sounds. And one of the reasons why we meditate in a quiet place is the same way. It's like taking away the triggers, which are usually so hard to realize what's going on, and make it pretty benign. We unstimulate ourselves. We come to a quiet, empty place. We quieten down the mind. We don't have the radio playing and the family running around at the same time, so we can actually have a chance to see what's going on. So it's quite a useful way of watching your mind.